Michael Crude talked about being in the Olympic Village on the morning of his Olympic final. And I remember thinking, someday I'm going to be a sports psychologist and I'm going to be in the Olympic Village with boxers that are winning Olympic medals. At the time, I was fascinated with psychology. I was a boxer, not very good. So boxing and psychology, even though in Ireland at the time, there was no sports psychologist. And that was it. That was as simple as the plan was. Roll on a few years later, I'm in Beijing with the Irish Olympic boxing team and we win the medals and we do it again in London.
Jerry, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me on.
I feel like we're connected already. So many people have either mentioned you on the pod or mentioned you to me. So welcome.
Great to have me. And I'm not sure who those people are, but I might owe them a few quid.
You do. I'll tell you who they are after. Laura is one of your biggest fans. Laura Bonner, she was on it recently and she was advocating for you strongly. So it's great to be connected to you. What do you do?
It's a tough question and it's a simple question. I think in one line, I help people get the noise out of their head. I help them ask the single most important question and get on with it then. I think that's what I do. I just empower people to get rid of the noise, get rid of the distraction. What's the real question you need to ask yourself? And then when you answer that, go do that.
What's the real question? Is it different for everybody?
Real question is always W-I-N, win. So I work a lot on win mindset, what's important now. So sometimes people want to come in and they want to spend 6 weeks telling me about their past, another 6 weeks worrying about the future. Sure, there is no past. It's fiction. It's just memory. It's gone. There's nothing more to give you. And there is no future. So the only thing we have is this moment. So now that that has happened, now that the past is gone, and now that we've absolutely no control of the future, if you really back to yourself, if you weren't afraid to fail, in this one short, beautiful life, if you believed in yourself and backed yourself, what would you do? And go do that.
What's people's reaction when you ask them that question?
A lot of people instantly know and they go do it. Like the likes of Laura, they just go do it. And a lot of people, it's the word but. And that's the greatest enemy we have. This word but. But is the gateway to excuses. But is the graveyard of dreams. But is the first step to ending a life of total regret.
So we talk about the body, the business, the brain on this podcast. And I like to, I would love to dive into the founder mindset, but I want to understand, how did you become a founder? Like, how did you start this business? Because it's a very unique career.
Yeah, very. It's like, you know, there's been no great plan to any of this, except as a young child growing up, suffered from a lot of anxiety, panic attacks, 2 suicide attempts. And you get to a point, 14 years old, where it's like, what the hell am I at here? So you're going from doctor to doctor to doctor. They're doing blood tests. They're doing lung tests. They're doing heart tests. They're trying to figure out why my heart is racing. They're trying to figure out why I have pains and headaches all the time. And eventually you kind of get this idea like, what? They're not finding anything. Every doctor was telling me I was perfectly healthy. Every test was coming back perfectly clear. And then eventually we did a brain scan and, you know, brain scan was something new. So we had multiple, all the other tests, but now we had a brain scan and you're kind of hoping that something would come back or something that they could fix. But then they come back and we were in an office with a pediatrician. And 2 things I noticed that day was at the minute when we met, he spoke to my mother about me for about 10 minutes while I was in the room. He never spoke to me. I'll never forget that. As a 14-year-old child sitting, watching this unfold, wondering, why is he talking to my mother? She doesn't have this anxiety. When we came back, I noticed he was reading the notes as he walked in, clearly being handed the results 10 seconds before he walked in the room. He sat down, went through them for a minute or two, scanned through everything at breakneck speed, never spoke to me and said to my mother, good news, everything is clear. You have a perfectly healthy young man. And my mother, who knew something wasn't right and had witnessed me not being right, refused to take that answer. And she said, you've missed something. And he said, we haven't missed anything. And he stood up because it was clearly our time to go. We spent our money. He had nothing more to give us. And now we're wasting his time. And he more or less begins to push my mother out. And my mother says, please, please, you have to do some other test. And he said, there are no more tests. And then he said, you've taken up and wasted enough professional people's time.
Wow.
And my mother said, but like, what is this? And he said, if you want my honest opinion, he's making this up so he doesn't have to go to school. I will never forget that moment. Jeez. That is the moment my life changed. Because A, you don't bark at my mother. And B, you don't just dismiss a child who was sitting there right in front of you with his world falling apart and dismiss everything without even speaking to him. That was the day I realized something has to be done here. And I am a great admirer of Western medicine. And I think much of what they do is incredible. And in many situations, it is miraculous what they do. But at that time, when it came to mental health and understanding the mind-body connection and the impact of trauma and the impact of emotions on organs, it clearly wasn't there. And my mother said, going home in the car, my mother said, don't worry, we'll get to the bottom of this. And I said, but what if there's nothing to get to the bottom of? And she said, there is, and we will. And when you do, you will help millions of people. That was my ignition moment. Malcolm Gladwell has an incredible book called Outliers. And he tracks people who became masters at what they do, whether it's an Olympic champion, a world champion, or a Nobel Prize winner. And the one thing you can track it back to is an ignition moment, where they experienced something and something in their heart said, that is the calling of my life now. And this has been the calling of my life, to answer this question. What was it that doctor missed? Because he was a great guy, a very kind human being. He wasn't doing it just out of deliberateness. There was clearly a deficit in what, in the understanding. And that has been my burning ambition, is to bring a whole new level of awareness to the mind-body connection, to the way our thoughts impact our cells, our genes, our biology, our chemistry, our nervous system, the impact of unresolved emotions, the impact of unresolved trauma. And what is the root cause of most illnesses in our modern world? It can be genes, it can be chromosomes. A lot of it is a lifestyle. And I've been saying that for almost 30 years now. And for 20 of those years, I was probably laughed at and ridiculed. But when you know something to be true, that's what I've always pursued, truth. And people might say, why do you go at this? Why do you risk, you know, the things I've been saying? And because there's a lot of mistruth out there, and there's a lot of misunderstanding out there, and there's a lot of people and organizations with agendas, and the agenda isn't truth. So I think that's what has fired me. So from being a sports psychologist to a lifestyle medicine, someone who's keenly just observing that all the time, to the events, the retreats that I do, the books that I write, it's all about one thing: bringing a greater, more connected, more truthful understanding about who we are as human beings.
Your mother was an incredibly evolved woman to be able to not take that at face value, because there's so many power structures in older Ireland, clergy, medicine. Even today, medicine is seen to be one of the last bastions of, like, they know what they're doing. What did she do then? How did she help you become what you are today?
You know, only recently, at an event I did, and I spoke about my mother and my dad and the massive impact they had on not just keeping me alive, but, you know, allowing me to step forward and study psychology. And, you know, when I said I wanted to study psychology, you know, my principal almost laughed at me. He went out to my parents' house and said, like, he's wasting his time. He'll never get the points. This isn't for him. He should join the guards. My parents have always backed me for some reason. It's like they believed in me. But somebody asked, surely recently, asked my mother, because she was sitting in the crowd, the first time she's ever came to one of my events, and somebody asked her, what did you do? She said, I have no idea. But I tell you what she did. She made me feel unconditionally loved. She let me know that the only failure in life is to have a question in your heart or have a dream in your heart that you don't go after. So my mother just made me feel loved even when I was at my worst, even when everyone else thought I was a bit odd, and she was just there with me all the time. And she always used to say, just go give it a go. You go, you back yourself. You have something special. And I just think it was her time, it was her presence, it was her steadfast presence and love that made me believe in myself and let me know that as long as I'm stepping courageously in the direction of my dreams, I'm not failing. And that ultimately, you know, one of the expressions she gave me is the greatest tragedy of life is not death. The greatest tragedy of life is arriving at the end and realizing we never lived. And my mother always said, you just go live. Figure out who you are, figure out what you want, and you go after that. And don't let anybody tell you you can't. And my mother taught me that a million times growing up, a million times. You can be anything. You can do anything. But what was always clear in my house was be a good person. Be a person of ethics and morality. Be considerate of other people. And as long as you're that, then go be anything you want to be. And the only thing I would say my dad would add to that was, and if you're going to do it bloody right. Matthew McConaughey has a great expression that says, you know, don't half-ass anything.
Yeah.
And my dad used to tell me that all the time. My mom would say, you can be anything you want to do. Just go after it. And my dad would say, and if you do, just do bloody well.
Mm.
So this idea of I've never, whether I'm cutting the lawn or whether I'm writing a book, I pride myself on doing it to the greatest of my ability. Every talk I do, every session I do with a corporate leadership team, every day I wake up, that could be the greatest, it could be the last day of my life. And every morning, that's why I spend an hour and a half, 2 hours getting myself ready for that day. I'm getting myself ready to put in the biggest shift of my life. And that's what I love. I love that idea. We get one shot at this. And we're not here to play small. And I'm not here to apologize. And I'm not here to dream small and play it safe. We get one crack at this thing. But you have to pursue something you love. And that's what my parents said. Make sure you love it. Make sure you're doing it for yourself. Make sure you're putting your heart and soul into it. Make sure you're playing the long game. Become a master. Nobody just likes, you know, don't just go after instant gratification. And I think that's how it's happened. It's just been that unconscious programming that I picked off from my parents. I just lived it out.
They were far ahead of their time. They were very ahead of their time considering, like, you know, back then I'm sure it wasn't the done thing to tell you to pursue your dreams. But I love that thing of how you do everything is how you do anything. Because there's this myth that you can just switch it on when you have to. I don't believe that. No. I believe exactly the same as you. If you can half-ass all the small things, you'll half-ass the big thing. You don't just suddenly arrive and you're ready to perform. You have to be the 1%.
Yeah.
You have to be training yourself every day to have a standard,
yeah,
to holding yourself to a standard.
When I worked with the Irish boxing team, we had an expression, I think it was Aristotle, we are what we repeatedly do.
Yep.
Excellence therefore is a habit, not an act. I think you have to become, you set a culture of excellence. And even now, my kid, I have a kid, 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and whether we're at a restaurant or whether we're out for a meal, we leave that table spotless. Something falls on the floor, we don't look for someone to clean it up. We go, we get a towel, we get a brush. This week down in, we were just back from hotel, and my little lad was eating granola and it fell on the floor, and he instantly went and asked for a brush and a dustpan. And somebody said, you know, oh, I'll do it. He said, no, thank you. I would like to do it. That's integrity. Because everybody gets up. Everybody's enough to do. And I think that's just a nice way to live your life. You know, be impeccable with your word first and foremost. So I often say to people, I'll meet you for coffee, Jerry, and I'll say no. Why? I have no interest. Will you come on my podcast? No, thank you. Would you do this? No. Why? Because I have no interest. Why? Either I have no interest in you, or I have no interest in what you're at. And I'll just say that straight out to people.
I feel special, Jerry. Thanks.
Well, so what I'm saying is you have to be impeccable with your word.
Yeah.
Integrity for me is simply doing what you said you're going to do. If I say I'm going to do it, I will absolutely do it. If I have any reservation whether I'm going to do it or not, I just say no, thank you. So I'm constantly saying yes to what I know I'm going to apply myself diligently and impeccably to. So I've never a million things on the go at any one time, because that's just the recipe of disaster. I carefully pick the projects. I carefully pick my clients. Who do I want to go for coffee with this week? Who do I want to have? And that's for me, you know, be impeccable with your word. Integrity is simply doing what I said you want to do. And when you live from a place of integrity and you're impeccable with your word, then sometimes people don't like what you say, but they respect it because you're honest. And I say to people, I could easily say yes. I could easily fob you off, say, oh yeah, we'll meet for coffee and then we won't, but I'm not going to do that. And I think I learned that from Doug Howlett, who was the amazing, you know, New Zealander who played rugby at Munster. And when I worked with Munster and I got to hang out, and I was meant to be his performance psychologist, but I think I learned more from him than he ever will from me. Doug was just the guy that would look you in the eye. And whether you liked what he was about to say or not, he was going to tell you the truth. So you said, Doug, how do you think that session went? You got the truth. How do you think? He just got the truth. And then somebody says, geez, Doug, like, you didn't need to say it like that. And he said, well, I could tell you a lie if you want, but I don't tell lies.
Was that his character?
That was just his character. He was just brought up by his dad or by his culture to be impeccable in what you do. And particularly that time in Munster, it was a family. We had a family. You don't lie to your family, like. So sometimes, like, somebody asks you straight out and you'd, fuck, you'd hate to tell the truth because like, I can't tell a lie.
Mm.
And we had that culture of, tell me, you know, make me uncomfortable. No matter how much I don't want to hear the truth, but do not tell me a lie, because that's when I fall out with you. So we had that rule, and I've tried to, from all the different incredible people that I've worked with, you know, in many walks of life, business and sport, and I'm always trying to absorb some of their character. It's like, could I live like that? Could I live with that idea? Like Doug Howlett, I'm not going to tell you a lie here. So I'm going to tell you something you probably won't want to hear. But you've asked me, and I don't tell lies. And then sometimes it means that I'm not the type of person that some people don't want on the podcast. Because I can't be told what to say. And I can't be told, well, be sure you kind of just fluff around the edges here and don't question the sponsor.
It drives me crazy. It just drives me insane, because you get this generic, and I can always tell. I had this experience very recently. Person came on, their PR coach for an inch of their life. And I'm like, oh my God. It's just generic, bland. We talked about it outside. People are afraid to say what they really, truly think, mm-hmm. in case they offend one person or one person of influence that they mm-hmm. believe. I love that thing about the truth. It's better to be punched in the face by a lie than kissed by better be punched in the face by the truth than kissed by a lie.
Yeah.
It's very true. How have you evolved your craft? Because you talked about Munster there and working in sport. Was sport your first area of calling?
Yeah, sport was, Irish Olympic boxing team. I went in there in 2004. Andy Lee was just back from the Olympic Games. I got to hang out with Andy Lee. If anyone knows Andy Lee, he's one of the most amazing human beings. First and foremost, you'll meet, what an intelligent human being. You can have a conversation with Andy on any topic and my God, will he blow you away. So he, you know, I learned so much from him. Then you move on, you're working with Munster and, you know, athletics, and you start working with different countries.
What was your dream, Jerry?
My dream was, in 1992, this is funny, I read Michael Carruth's book, Ring of Gold, and he was just having the Olympic. And I probably knew at that stage, either A, I thought I wasn't good enough to be an Olympic boxer, or it wasn't. But in it, he spoke about being in the Olympic Village and going for walks with his sports psychologist. And at the time, I was fascinated with psychology. I was a boxer, not very good. So boxing and psychology, even though in Ireland at the time, there was no sports psychologist, and they brought in a lady called Felicity Heathcliff at the time to work with them. But Michael Carruth talked about being in the Olympic Village on the morning of his Olympic final. And I remember thinking, someday I'm going to be a sports psychologist and I'm going to be in the Olympic Village with boxers that are winning Olympic medals. And that was it. That was as simple as the plan was. Roll on a few years later, I'm in Beijing with the Irish Olympic boxing team and we're winning medals and we do it again in London. And that was as much as my dream was at the start. It was to be to work with some of the greatest people. I remember when I was 18 or 19, who do I want to work with? I put Irish Olympic boxing, Munster rugby, even though I grew up in Galway, never played rugby, but there was something about them I loved. There was something about them I admired. So it was to put myself in the heat of battle with the most ambitious, most successful teams so that I could learn as much as I possibly can. And they were my two goals, work with Munster rugby and be an Olympic psychologist, working with Olympic boxing teams in the Olympic Village.
The best plans are simple.
That's as simple as it was.
They are, though. We over-engineer a lot of things and it cripples people because they feel they have to have it mapped out. There's this culture of you have to have everything mapped out from the time you're 15. Where are you going to go to school? Where are you going to go to college? What are you going to do after college? Like this crippling pressure on people. Me and my wife are having this discussion recently about Willow, a girl's two. And we're like, oh, you know, you daydream. Oh, what do you think she'll do? You know, the fun conversations you have. Like, you've kids around the same age. And I was like, I said something very similar to what you said there. I said, you know what? I don't mind what she does as long as she goes at it with passion.
Mm.
No matter what it is. I don't care. I care that she'll be happy, but she pursues with passion. And like the best people I talk to, often you're blown away by the simplicity of it. Because we think, oh, there's a secret sauce. That's why I love doing this podcast, because it, especially long form, you really get to the meat of it. You get to understand what drives Thierry Hussey. And it was to be in the Olympic Village with Olympic boxers.
Yeah.
It takes courage and belief in yourself and your business idea to take the step to set up your own business. In the early stages, entrepreneurship can be a lonely road, even through milestone moments. Deciding to commit the idea you've been mulling over, learning, growing, and developing your skills, building a team to help you along the way, and preparing to launch into new markets. Enterprise Ireland is there for all of those startup moments. From providing advice and guidance to new founders through our startup network, to pre-seed funding and early investment, we're here to help you bring your ambition to fruition. To find out how Enterprise Ireland can help you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com.
Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of The Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code VOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie. Use code FOX20 and elevate your marketing game today.
Nostra, an Irish IT company, offers world-class managed IT services, cloud solutions, IT support, and more, all tailored to meet your business needs. So, whether you're streamlining operations or boosting productivity, their expert team is ready to help you. Visit nostra.ie or email info@nostra.ie to see how they can help solve your IT challenges today.
And that's as simple as it is. And the business has evolved from that. You know, at one point then you discover more and more people. I remember being at a Joe Dispenza, you know, and if anyone knows Joe Dispenza, I think he's incredible. And I'm at this event and there's probably 1,000 people in there. And it's just before COVID. And I just watch him deliver with, he never missed a beat. All day long, no note. And I said, that's a guy that's at the top of his game. So most nights I like to do a debrief of the day. And that day, I asked, what blew me away today? I said, Dispenza blew me away. Why? His knowledge, he could just go from the gut microbiome to the analysis of the brain. He could just comfortably step with authority. Then I said, his ability to hold an audience for an entire day. And then I said, he was really, you know, no notes. And I said, I won't do that. I came home, COVID hit. I said, how am I going to do events now? And COVID was in full swing. And
what were you doing at the time?
At the time, I was doing this performance psychology, sports psychology, and I was doing some small events. And that was really it.
All in the sports arena?
Some of the public events were beginning to be public. But no online stuff, no books, no big events, no retreats, nothing like that. They're only 3 or 4 years old.
Yeah, so this was 2020. This was kind of starting
this
to change.
This was 2020.
For you.
So okay. I think it was end of 2020. I went in and I asked myself, okay, how many people had dispense in the room? 1,000. So I wrote that down. What venue in Ireland has 1,000 capacity? The National Concert Hall came up. I said, right, let's go and have a look at that. And I remember I walked in and the lady that runs the concert hall, Catherine, has been a great believer in me. And she thought I was crazy. She's like, Jerry, we're in lockdown. I'm like, I know. And the only date we've available right now is this date, but like, we're still going to be locked down. I said, Catherine, I'm booking the concert hall. But you know you're going to have to pay a deposit. And she said, I'm not giving you your money back. I said, don't worry. It'll all be open. And she's like, are you crazy? I stood on the stage of the concert hall and I looked out at 1,000 seats. I said, I'm going to have an event here from 9:30 in the morning to 4:30.
Oh,
7 hours nonstop. I'm not going to use one slide. I'm not going to use one note. And I'm going to manifest what I was inspired by. I'm going to test myself now. How well do I really know this? How well can I really present?
How far in advance was this? When are we standing? When are we standing on the concert hall?
I'd say we're probably doing 4 or 5 months later.
Okay.
Yeah. And the fair is I have an incredible wife who backed me and said, yeah, go to that. And we didn't have a whole lot of money in the business. I said, right, let's pay the deposit. Let's go.
The concert hall is some venue.
And Catherine said to me, you're going to lose your deposit. I said, don't be worrying about that. And then I started manifesting every day. So I started visualizing what would be to be an incredible deliverer of content. I started really honing in on what topics am I going to become a master at? What topics am I not going to speak about? What topics? So I really started to hone in on that. Where's my passion? What's my focus? What do I want to become world-class at? And how do I become someone? Because when I was growing up, I had a terrible speech impediment. I had a stammer. I couldn't speak. And I visualized this day in, day out, day. I had a mantra. And one of the mantras then, you know, had to change to the concert hall will be packed to the rafters. And we're going to be closed. Eventually it got to half capacity. And we went in for rehearsal. We went in and she said, good news is half capacity. So we sold out half capacity. And then I said to her, no, it's going to be packed to the rafters. She's like, Jerry, unless something massive shifts. And then with about 3 weeks to go, she rang me up and said, you must be tapped into something. We've just got notice that we can be at full capacity 2 days before your event. I said, great. And she said, but you'll have to have masks on. I said, there'll be no masks, Catherine. She said, Jerry, this is government. I said, it is now. There'll be no mask mandate for my event. 12 o'clock the night before, the mask mandate ended. We had 1,000 people. We had 1,200 people in the National Concert Hall. It was electric. And I stepped out on that stage with no note. And I said, now, you either can do this or you can't. That was the moment. In Dispenza, whatever he did, whatever he said, however he brainwashed us, I walked out of there and said, I can do whatever I want to do now. I can run events. I can run retreats all over the world. I'm going to write best-selling books. I'll just go do it.
What do you think it was, Jerry?
It was just stop the waffle, stop doubting yourself, stop worrying about what if you fail, stop getting distracted with projects, just focus now and just map it out and do not get distracted, do not let doubt or fear, do not allow it. And that's why I just literally locked myself away for a couple of months. I wasn't listening to the news. I didn't want to hear about 50% capacity, or I just didn't allow that to come in. I just kept seeing myself delivering and speaking and just the energy I wanted to create, because, you know, Ireland, it was such a divisive time, you know, vaccinated, unvaccinated. Everyone was round and arguing and fear. And I just said, for one day, what if I could light this place up with joy and love and passion? and show the world that, you know, life is still worth fighting for. And there's still, in, you know, this is still a world worth fighting for. And so that was my driving force. I want to reconnect people. I want to take away division. I want to speak about inclusion. I want to show people, if you can get 1,200 people together and all of them are coming from a place of joy and love and there's no comparison, there's no judgment, and you just drop people out of their heads and into their heart and you make them believe in themselves again and you activate that heart and that soul and you bring that spirit alive and you have 1,000 or 1,200 people in a venue and their spirits are screaming at each other and they're screaming, I can and I will. And nothing is a problem at that moment. And they've let go of their past. They're not daunted by the future. That's magic. And after the event, that's what people felt. We even had a journalist turn up that I didn't know was coming. And she came to dismiss the whole thing. And she was writing for a national paper on this voodoo waffle crap. And her article at the end was, I attended this, and she was open. And this is why I attended it. But I can't deny what I felt.
Interesting.
I can't deny what I felt in that space. And I can't deny what I felt when I walked out. Truth is truth. It's not my truth. When you drop people back into their own power and you reconnect them with their own dreams and you strip away fear and you strip away self-doubt and you say, right now, let's go. That's like, they've just realized I've been living in fear and waffle and telling myself stupid stories and hanging on to the past. And I didn't need to have any of those stuff.
Especially then though, Jerry, especially at that time.
Especially at that time.
People were locked in their head, literally, figuratively, metaphorically, everything locked in. Interesting that mainstream media were coming at you at that angle.
Well, and you know, I welcome criticism and I'm not always right. And I regularly put myself in front of critics. And I regularly put myself in front of people who totally don't agree because I'm not always right. And there might be a gap in the way I'm thinking because we all have blind spots. So I welcome criticism. I welcome someone, particularly if they come and say, Jerry, either this is what you said or you refer to this piece of science. I've dug into this. I've looked at it and you're wrong and here's the proof. Then of course welcome that. But I don't really like, well, I don't like what Jerry's saying because it made me feel uncomfortable. Well, like
hand waving and kind of, I just don't like it. You're like, well, that's not really an argument, is it?
You know,
I just don't like
come,
it.
Did you experience it? So, So firstly, I welcome challenge. I don't get it right all the time. I have to correct myself at times. That's the nature of anybody who is in the pursuit of truth and growth is always learning, always.
Things change, like your knowledge changes, your knowledge base changes, the world changes, science changes. Yeah. Like you have to, if you're still saying the same thing you were saying 10 years ago, you haven't grown.
I think in that event, I think what Dispenza did was he connected me back to my truth. And what he was doing was turn off the bloody head and turn off the ego and turn off the fear and activate love. If you've truly loved yourself, this is what I ask all my clients. If you truly loved yourself in this one short life, what would you dare do? And just go do that. That was the first time in my life I said, just go do it.
How did you feel after coming off that stage?
I just said, this is what I was born to do. This is what I was born to do. And those people there that probably hadn't smiled in months or years, and they smiled and they cried and they laughed and they danced and they shook. It was my first chance. You put psychology, because talk therapy is great, but you can't remove trauma from the body by talking. You can't do that. You have to scream it out, chant it out, move it out of the body. You have to reset the nervous system. And I got people coming in there, skeptics, and next thing they would, you have 7 hours of intense, you work through the mind, you work through the body, you regulate the vagus nerve, you change the frequency, you get them chanting new stuff. So they're changing the neurological pathways of the brain. It is a complete mind, body, spirit rewiring. And I didn't tell them what to do. But everyone walked out there saying, now I fucking know what I want to do with my life. Now I know the people I'm not going to hang around with anymore. Now I know the story I'm not going to tell myself anymore. Now I know the shitty thing from my past I've been hanging on to. Now I know it. And now that I know it, I also know that I have a freedom to let that go. I talk a lot about the power of choice. We can't always control what happens to us in our life, but we always control our response. And I saw people bounce out of there saying, you know what? I don't fucking need you anymore. And I just need to back myself. And that's what I love. I love dropping people back into their heart, back into their truth, back into certainty, recognizing that the greatest tragedy of life is not death. The greatest tragedy of life is arriving at the end and realizing you never lived.
Did this put you on a different pathway?
Like it ultimately depends on like whether you think we have a predefined path or not. Like what path was I meant to be on? I've no idea because I've never had a long-term plan.
You were mainly sports psychology, right? You were mainly a sports psychologist up to that point.
Yeah, but I would also say, like, when I sat and watched Dispenza that day, if I was so I think I'd fallen out of love with sports psychologists because I'd worked with Olympic champions and world champions. And I remember waking up in Beijing one morning at a track cycling world championships. And when I woke up, where one time ago, I would be so excited. I just said, God, I can't wait to go home now. I had it done.
Yeah.
So I think the very fact that when I watched Dispenza and I said to myself, that's the next step. I wouldn't have been thinking like that unless the passion had died. Now, I slowly come back into sport, but I left it behind. And that was dangerous because at that point, I'd built my reputation as a sports psychologist. I was, you know, in demand by top teams. I had financial security. And I walked away from it all. I walked away and said, right, let's try this. Let's write a book. Let's go to this other side of stuff. Public events, public retreats. And it was like, but you've just spent 10 years getting to a place of safety. And I'm like, yeah, and I'm bored of it now. So I have to follow my own medicine.
Well, you weren't growing anymore, obviously. Personally, you probably weren't growing as much as you wanted to.
Exactly, exactly.
But so, it makes you a better sports psychologist to be more rounded, to deal with CEOs, to deal with the public, because you're bringing in all this knowledge. So if you... I'm sure you're back doing it now. It probably makes you a better sports psychologist because you're more rounded. Would that be correct?
I just think it makes you a better person. I think it, like ultimately, athletes often say to me, you know, will I go for another Olympic Games or will I retire? I just ask them, what do you think you should do?
I was going to say, surely that's the wrong person to ask.
Yeah. So I think all I've ever done, like what's my next 5-year plan? I don't have one. I'm going to bravely and courageously step into passion every day. I'm going to listen to my heart. And what I do sometimes doesn't make sense to the public, but it makes sense to me. And I love that idea that at the best, our business has a 3-year plan. And it is whatever we do, do it to a world-class standard. Whatever we say, be impeccable with a word, be able to back it up. Whatever we do, do it with love. Put our heart and soul into it and do it until you decide it's time to do something else. And I think that's it. We've never had financial real goals. We've never talked about building a brand or building followers or this is a lifelong mission for me. It's about that kid that struggled with anxiety and thought his life was worthless and got to the point where he thought about ending his own life. This is about giving that child a chance to live a life beyond his wildest dreams, to meet amazing people, to have experiences that he never thought he would have. That's what my life is about. It's not about other people. If the work I do helps other people, well, that's good too. But this is about me having a life of experiences that are beyond my wildest dreams.
I love that because I find so many people online are just so full of shit. My goal is to impact 1 million people. You're like, oh, would you give it a rest, man? You're fucking making me sick here. Like, come on. Like, I just find it so smacks of such inauthenticity by just trying too hard. If you could impact 1 million people, brilliant. But realistically, save yourself and then save everyone around you and then slowly build that out. It's just, I find it very, so I love to hear someone say, honestly, look, it's about my own journey and my own adventure. What? I want to talk to you about the planning thing. How do you balance that off? Because you work with elite performers, elite athletes, elite CEOs. How do you balance the planning versus the passion? because we have to have some sort of a plan. How do you balance that?
Yeah, I think the passion for me is, firstly, is what projects do I want to be involved in? And when I set my business up, those three goals I set, and they're all on the one word freedom. So I want freedom to work when I want and run my own diary. I wanted freedom to work with only clients that inspire me, and I wanted financial freedom. Thankfully, I have all three, which is incredible. Now, took a long time to get there. Mm-hmm. But that's an incredible gifted place to be. So now I get to choose the projects I'm involved in. I get to choose. So the planning, the passion for me is the center of everything. Then the planning is the diary. So I only allow myself to work a maximum of 160 days a year. So 150 to 160, that's all. Because I need to rest, I need to recover, I need to go on courses, I need to learn, I need to be at my best. I need to be at home with my children. So I know how many days a year I can work in order to, for me to be at my best. Then I break those down into weeks. I break that down into projects. So when I'm asked to do a project, the question I'm asking is, how much time does it require to do this at a world-class standard? That's very simple. Then I have that time. I know what my daily rate is. So I say to my client, you want me for 20 days a year? No problem. That's the cost. If they even hesitate, they're not the client for me. And I just move on. And I think that's been a big lesson of mine. Know your worth. And if people have a conversation around cost, what's the cost of having Jerry in the business? They're starting at the wrong place. I love sitting in front of a CEO who's really challenging me and probably doesn't maybe know who the hell I am and doesn't believe in some of this and says, I think this is bullshit, Jerry. But let me ask you, what's the value you think you're going to bring? Now, that's a great question. What's the value you're going to bring here? And if you take my senior leadership team away for 3 days, the cost I understand. Now, what's the value? What are you going to do for them? So it's this return on investment. So it's not a waffly kind of, sure, we'll have a few pints and we'll go away and they'll come back. What? They'll come on. So for me, everything I do has to have a performance impact. So whether you're working with a GA team or a Formula One team or an Olympic boxing team or a business team, every hour and every cent you spend should have a performance impact that is measurable, demonstrable and understandable. So I had to learn that language really quickly. So you're sitting with a CEO. So for me, when I look at my business, I analyze and assess every project based on that. So what is our dream? Where do we want to be in 3 years' time? How does this project connect with that? Is it with people who are up to be world-class? Because there's no point in me trying to deliver a world-class program to people who are happy being mediocre. So are they really up for world-class and have the finance to fund it? So I have a very simple, and that takes me probably 90 seconds to go through every project I'm offered. And it's a quick yes or a quick no. But if I'm in, I'm all in. Mm. And that's what I say to my clients. Are you really up for this? Some people bring me up, I love a bit of coaching. Are you really up for this?
Mm.
Because I think of Doug Howlett. Doug Howlett surrounded himself with the greatest players in the world for a reason. And there's a lot of companies that want you to get in and do a bit of motivation, a bit of entertainment, and it's a bit of crack and won't really change anything. No interest in that type of stuff. You want to be world class. You want to be the best in the world that you want to be. You want to be Olympic champion. You want to be world champion. You want to build a business, 100 million a year. Why 100 million? Why would you settle for that? Just questions I ask. Where's 100 million come into your head?
Yeah, that was the next question I had, is in how do you define, how do you sense if someone has what it takes to be world class?
Well, if someone, firstly, it's commitment. So if you're coached by me, you're meeting me at 5:30 or 6:00 three mornings a week. And if you start going missing, you're not up for it. So I have a group of CEOs, group of elite business people that I coach. And I always say that getting into this group should be really hard. Staying in is even harder. You quickly find out who's, and you quickly figure out if they're up for it or not. And if you're not up for it, no problem. But like, this program is empowering people to become world class at what they do. This isn't the mediocre program. This isn't the waffle program.
It's to make you feel good. I think a lot of people do things to make themselves feel good.
And I'm not going to sit here and tell you what I think you want to hear so that you keep me employed. That's not my role. My role is to observe, assess, and in the most loving, respectful way, tell you the truth about you and your business. Based on my years of observing high-performing people and high-performing organizations, I'll give you my best shot and I will be absolutely honest. And every time you meet me, I will be honest to my core. And I will give you my heart and my soul and I will move mountains to make you and your business successful. But you got to meet me with the same level of honesty and integrity, and you got to meet me with the same level of passion. So go away and think about whether you want this. Because a lot of companies get me in with love. And they're nearly shocked because, like, geez, Jerry, I thought you'd be delighted with the gig. I don't need a gig. I'm not interested in a gig. Or like they say, but Jerry, geez, it's only a couple of days work. And, you know, it's a handsome reward. I'm not interested in that. What's the performance impact? Can I change the direction? Can I change the culture of this team? Can I ask this team a question they've never thought of before? Can I make people turn up more calm, more focused? What if I built a connection in this team that they've never had before? A trust, a love, an understanding. What if there was, you know, a cohesion in this team that was equal to the greatest sports team in the world? What if there was an honesty? What if there was something here that was just a magical spirit? Where people backed each other, where people turned up for each other, where people really cared deeply about each other, where we don't focus on the problem, we focus on solution. We don't manage risk, we optimize opportunity. Where we really go after that? What would that look like? Because that's what I'm interested in. And anything other than that, I'd be saying no thanks.
But this is what Ireland needs, Jerry. It's very un-Irish. A lot of stuff you're saying there is very kind of like, Asher, it'll be grand. Asher, look.
And it will be grand. If grand is what you want, then fine.
100%, right? But there is definitely a cohort of people in Ireland who are striving to be world class now. I think we've shaken off the shackles of self-doubt a little bit, not fully. But I think there is people like you who are shifting mindsets and providing examples. I always say on the podcast, you got to see it to be it. That's just why I love doing this podcast, because you show people, look, Jerry did this. This is how Jerry operates. You know, Jerry comes from Galway. You come from Galway. Like, there are similar traits you can see here. So you have to see it to be it. And if it does for one person listening today, what Joe Dispenza did for you, that's the unlock we're seeking here. So talk to me then about your process. Like there's founders listening. And I want them to kind of get into your mind and go, right, how do you create an environment of excellence? I talked to my friend about this last night. We're at Pat Dively's book launch. And I was talking to him about creating an environment of excellence within this media company. How do you think about creating environments of excellence?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's a very model that it works. So lead self, lead others, lead teams, lead business. Personal excellence is the first step to culture of excellence. So wake up every morning, look at the food you're eating, listen to the thoughts you're thinking, take your top off, look in the mirror. That's the truth. Are you turning up with excellence? So one time ago, I used to sit with people and say, oh, you know, I suffer from a lot of anxiety. And while they're doing that, they're on their third coffee while they're chatting to me. And they're having two chocolate biscuits. And I'm like, do you not know about the gut-brain axis? Do you not know about the mind-body connection? Do you not know caffeine drives adrenaline? Do you not know the ultra-processed food drives anxiety and depression? So, like, what do you want? I'd do anything to get rid of these panic attacks. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. You're going to cut out all ultra-processed food. You're going to start doing exercise for 30 minutes every single morning. We're going to get into ice water therapy. We're going to get you fitter, stronger than you've ever had before. And I think it's from that place of excellence. Then you start to turn up in the business. You're more calm. You're more focused. You see things in a new way. And now you've created this gap between stimulus and response. So a problem happens in the business and there's not panic. You take a deep breath and you say, right, let's work through this. So now you're turning up in the business. You're calmer. You're more focused. You're more resilient. You're not getting distracted. You're in a meeting that's people are getting annoyed and you have the ability to stay calm and relaxed and ask great questions. I think too many people, so I always say the right people with the right process never worry about the outcome. But there's a lot of people who are highly stressed, who are not sleeping very well, whose diet isn't good, who don't meditate as much as they should, and they're trying to be high performers. So I recently had a group of a really incredible business who were really trying to become the best in the world. And they're all sitting in a room and all sitting there, how do you become the best in the world? So I said, how many of the 10 of you, you know, exercised this morning? I think two hands went up. How many meditated? None. How many would say your diet is as good as it needs to be? None of them. How many say you sleep enough? None. How many of you have, recovery protocols? None. I said, okay. And then I said, imagine over here, I have 10 other seats and I have the 10 greatest athletes in the world sitting there. So I said, who do you think? So some of them picked, Federer and Nadal, Djokovic. Some of them picked Lewis Hamilton. So I let them pick. And I said, imagine I asked those 10 people who exercised today. How many hands would go up? 10. Who meditated today? Who used visualization today? Who sleeps well? And then they all start laughing. I said, if those athletes lived like ye lived, do you think they'd be the best in the world at what they do? No. I think everything starts with a personal commitment to personal excellence. Now, that's not obsessively training. It's not like being obsessive with your diet. Obsession is another, dysfunction. Was actually looking at myself and saying, am I really at my best here? Am I really turning up? Because like if you lead an organization and there's 1,000 people working in your organization, that's 1,000 households who depend on your company to pay the bills. They depend on you. So they're trusting you. And that doesn't and shouldn't come lightly. So I think you want to build a culture of excellence in the business. You want to build a culture of excellence in a Formula One team. It starts with the leader. The leader has to be somebody who lives from a place of excellence, who meditates, who exercises. Like, I think high-level business is actually more demanding than the sport, because sport is like you have a clear start of the season, you have an end of the season. You have a certain amount of matches. They all have sleep coaches. They all have psychologists. They all have nutritionists. And then at the end of the season, if you win, you're told, great, take 4 weeks off now and relax. But at the end of the year in business, when you hit your targets, does anyone say take 4 weeks off and relax? No, they say, that's great. Now 10% to go again. And I think...
Jerry, is it... This can't be new information to people, right? This can't be like, oh my God, Jerry.
No, it's not new. Why? Couldn't be new.
Oh, exercise. That's a great idea. But so why are people doing it then?
Because it's the stories we tell ourselves. I haven't time. It's not for me. It wouldn't really work. People are just, it's the stories. It's the environment. It's the people you surround yourself with. It's like I always thought my diet was really good until you spend a day with Novak Djokovic. Then you realize your diet is crap. So who you surround yourself with? And people say to me, but sure, everybody goes out for a few pints. Sure, everybody does that. Who does that? You mean everyone that you know?
Yeah.
So I think the masses and mediocrity go hand in hand. So if you're doing what the masses do in mediocrity, you'll be fine. In all the stuff I do, I talk about the 1%. If you think and move and eat and act like the 99%, then you'll have what the 99% have. But if you want to have what the 1% have, you're going to have to do what the 1% do. And when I look at these athletes who can achieve success over and over again, who overcome adversity, who can stay calm in the most pressurized environments, it's not a God-given talent or it's not a genetic code that they have. It's something they've learned through years of meditation, visualization, watching their diet. Now, a lot of them would sometimes rather stay in bed and eat crap, but they have this idea. This is my dream, so I have to align intention with attention. If my intention is to be the best in the world, then I have to break that down. If you want to be the number one tennis player in the world, you've got to break your game probably down into 100 understandable, measurable metrics. And then you have to become the best in the world at each of those metrics.
Why do people jump on and jump off? Why do people do this for like 6 weeks, 10 weeks, 12 weeks and jump off? You see that so many times. Oh, I was flying and then sure luck, went for a stag or blah, blah, blah. Is that the story? Is the tape just resetting back to the start?
I think ultimately it's the subconscious program. And if I go back to Dispenza, I think it's like I would always say to this. If I said to you, me now, if someone come in here and said, lads, would you jog all the way to Galway without stopping? Like, you look fairly fit. I think I'm fairly fit.
I'd give you a chance. I'd give you a run.
We'd probably we'd give it a shot. But like, would we do it? Now, if someone walked in here and said, somebody has kidnapped your kids, lads. They're going to die unless ye can get to Galway without stopping in 24 hours. There's not a doubt in my head that we do it. So what shifted? The why shifted.
Yeah.
And I do this on stage sometimes. I get a chair, I put 120 kgs on the chair, and I slowly load it up and I ask people questions like, who goes to the gym every day? Who lifts weights all every day? So they're saying no. Who likes making a fool of themselves? And then I ask, who thinks they'd lift this chair right now? 1,000 people in the room, very few hands go up. And then I say, imagine your 2-year-old child is trapped underneath them. There's nobody else in this building. The only way that your child's going to live is if you can lift this chair 2 inches in 10 seconds. If you think you could lift the chair 2 inches now, put your hands up. Every hand goes up. What changed? Most people don't know why they're living. They don't know, I need to get fit. Why? I need to make 100 million. Why? I need to climb Everest. Why? If I another person comes to me, I want to climb Everest. And I say, what are you looking for? What are you hoping to find on top? I don't know. I'm going to do
the answer isn't up there,
I'm
John.
I'm going to do 32 marathons in 32 minutes. Why? I don't know. Is it self-punishment? Is it from guilt? What are you trying to find? I think most people, if you really ask them what the hell is your life about, they don't know. So therefore, you can have the what and the how, but they don't know why they're doing it. When your why is strong enough, nothing distracts you. So for me, I know when my diet goes bad. I know when I don't do the work. I become scared. I become anxious. I know the person. And I know when I do the work, I'm limitless.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that's the gift I give myself. The other thing I look at is, you know, particularly when you look at this chronic stress and chronic illness. And we know now, nobody can doubt, a vast majority of illnesses that are killing people are lifestyle created. So I had children late in life. It's probably 30 years away till one of my children get married. Every morning I ask myself, I don't ask myself, do I want to get into an ice tank? Because the answer is no. Do I really want to go in? I ask myself every morning, do I want to be at my children's wedding? And if so, how do I want to be? I want to be strong. I want to dance with my daughter. I want to walk her up the aisle. I visualize myself on the morning of my son's wedding, tying his tie, kissing him on the cheek and telling him that I love him. I can't guarantee that's going to happen, but all the science and research says I can stack that in my favor every single morning. So every morning we wake up, we have a chance and a choice. A chance to see the sunrise, a chance to rebalance our nervous system, a chance to forgive, a chance to let go, a chance to start again, and a choice whether we take that or not. I think we have to have an incredible why that drives us in a loving way, not an obsessive way. But I've never drank. I've never smoked. I don't need to. I don't need to engage in crap. So I think people just don't know the why sometimes.
Mm.
And they want to do incredible stuff, but they don't do it because they fell off the wagon. Well, why did you fall off? Either I didn't believe in myself or my subconscious program actually didn't believe it would happen or didn't really want it in the first place. And Viktor Frankl's incredible book, Man's Search for Meaning, who I think is one of the greatest books of all time. And I know it's probably referenced by every human being on the planet. And I'd say everyone that's on your podcast references it.
We do ask everyone for recommendations.
It's an incredible book. And ultimately, the two things he says is, we don't always control what happens to us in our life, but we always control our response. And secondly, he says, he who has a why will find a how. He said to me, but it's not easy. I don't care whether it's easy or not. Sure, if it was easy, everyone would do it.
Mm.
So it's probably not easy. I'm not interested in easy. Is it real? And does it lead to a greater life of freedom and liberation and truth? And if it does, then that's the path for me.
Bring me through a day in your life.
Day in my life is pretty simple. In some ways, it's boring. I wake most mornings before 6 o'clock, 5:30. By six, I'm in the gym. Three mornings a week, I take a bunch of clients, these guys that I coach. We start around 6:15. We train for an hour. So most mornings for me is an hour of physical exercise. Then it's cold water immersion, either in the sea or a shower. Then it's meditation. So that takes up about an hour and a half. Then it's breakfast with my kids. They go off to school. I work most days from 9 until 1.
How do you work?
It's a great mix. Some days I'm off site with a corporate organization. Some days I'm leading a team of business leaders in the Alps. Some days I'm doing sessions on Zoom. Sometimes I'm doing one-to-one sessions where we, and a typical one-to-one session for me, I'd meet someone, we'd go for a swim in Dunleary. We'd go for a walk, we'd sit down, we'd have some breakfast together and we'd chat through some stuff that needs. So that's kind of my life. Or then other days I'm heading off to do an event. I'm heading off to Portugal to do retreats. But every day is the same. So every day I wake up at the same time. Every day I go through the same process of an hour and a half. Every day I probably eat the same breakfast. So no matter where I am or what I'm doing, there's a familiarity to the process. Follow the process. I know what that, and I always think in the morning, it's the rudder of the day. If you win that morning, if you can get to 7 o'clock in the morning and you've changed your biology, you've changed your chemistry, you've balanced your nervous system, you've created, you know, endocannabinoids in the brain, you've released endorphins, you've practiced your breath work, you're in a state of calm and focus and empowerment, then bring on the day. You'll still meet the challenges, you'll still meet the assholes, but you'll meet them from a totally different place. If you get to 7 o'clock in the morning and you're anxious, you haven't balanced your nervous system, you haven't practiced visualization, you haven't practiced gratitude, you're in a stress mode, there's cortisol and adrenaline in your system.
Are you chasing the day? People often wake up and they're chasing. They're late for school, they're late for work, they're late for this, they're late for that. I'm like, that's just getting up earlier.
Mm.
There's no magic to that.
No.
I just don't understand. Oh, sorry, sir. Oh, the buzz and the traffic. And you.
I know.
I don't want to hear that.
I know. And you know, some of this stuff is so simple. It's 15 minutes. So it's amazing. Like I had a session with a bunch of clients this morning. We literally did 18 minutes of work. And they all felt radically different. So it was a little bit of, we got their heart rate up. We got the sweat moving. We did certain exercises to get the lymphatic draining system moving. We did 3 minutes of regulating the vagus nerve. We did about a 4 minute meditation and I asked them at the end, how do they feel? Fucking radically different. You can change your biology, change your chemistry. You can change your gene and cell expression. You can change your brain activity and brain waves in 15 minutes. That's 1% of your day. I find it hard to buy this excuse. I don't have time.
Is that the biggest lie people tell themselves?
Yeah, time is all we have. So like we're all born and we die. And in between that is only time. What you do with the time. You can't manage time, but you can manage yourself and your time. To find 15 minutes, like I always do this in exercise, and anyone listening to this can do it. There's 168 hours in every week. Write down what you do with those 160 hours. Now it's easy. Well, I sleep 7 hours a week, seven, that's 49. I work 50, that's 90. So it's very good. So you get to about 140 hours, and then you can say, hold on a second here. I guarantee you, no matter who does this exercise tonight, you're going to come up with 15 to 20 hours per week that you can't. You don't know what you do with it because you're distracted.
You're on your phone.
You're scrolling.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. So people say, I have no time until I say, show me where your time goes. And then we don't realize it. So that's a lovely, simple exercise. And for me, it's 15 minutes. And there's some days I only have 15 minutes. But 15 minutes is a long, long time. 3 minutes. I work with high-performance athletes who can go through a complete reset trigger in under a minute before they take the penalty, before they take that shot to win the Masters, before they do that thing. They have to go from a state of dysregulation, fatigue, stress, and in a minute, you can change your biology, you can change your chemistry, You can change your neurological pathways. You can active open up the prefrontal cortex of the brain. You can shrink the size of the amygdala, which is a stress limbic center, in a minute. So sometimes this reset trigger is like you can run around the whole day stressed and in unhelpful emotions and full of cortisol and full of stress. Well, if you just stopped for a second and if you had practiced and you had a simple trigger, all of that can stop in under a minute.
All right, do it with me. Reset trigger right now. How do you do it?
So reset trigger, first thing is breathing. First thing is breathing. So the fastest way to go from sympathetic to parasympathetic is 5 deep breaths. So the first thing is close your eyes and just practice 5 deep breaths. I want you to breathe in through the nose and I want you to breathe in for 3 or 4 seconds and then breathe out, making sure the exhale is longer than the inhale. So let's do that 3 or 4 times. While you're doing that, just move your neck left and right. The tension, all those cranial nerves are running down your neck. Move your shoulders a little bit. And just take a deep breath. I want you to repeat this after me right now. I am not my environment.
Out loud?
Out loud or to yourself, it doesn't matter.
Okay. I'm not my environment.
I'm not my past.
I'm not my past.
I'm not what other people expect.
I'm not what other people expect.
I am me.
I am me.
I am a conscious creator of my own reality.
I'm a conscious creator of my own reality.
And at all times, I choose my response.
At all times, I choose my response.
And just take a deep breath. Squeeze your hands nice and tight. And as you exhale, breathe out. Let's do that 3 more times. Now think of the person that means the most to you in your life. Can you see their face?
Mm-hmm.
Can you see their eyes? Can you see them smile? How lucky are you to have that person in your life? How lucky are you to be able to sit here and speak with me? To have the gift of hearing, the gift of sight, the gift of walk, you have food to eat, you have a warm bed to sleep in, and tonight you get to go to bed with someone you love. Take a deep breath. What does courageous look like right now? What does brave look like right now? What does gratitude look like right now? Now let's go live that. How does that feel?
Powerful.
It's simple.
It's simple, but not easy. Right?
It's taking ownership. We let stories run through our head. This isn't fair. My life is hard. Good things don't work for me. It's hard to meet someone you love. Business is tough. Well, if that's your story, that's your reality. Every word you say primes the reticular activating system of the brain. The reticular activating system of the brain is the part that is responsible for where your attention goes. So the things you say, the things, the pictures you create, create an internal unconscious picture. It's called pattern matching. Once we have that deeply held belief about the world, about ourselves, about the universe, about what's going to happen, then our conscious mind is only allowed to go into the world and pick the things that match that. So we create this echo chamber. I'm unlucky. Life is hard. My team are useless. I never get it. So the first thing is stop, take a deep breath, reset your nervous system. Listen to the story you're allowing yourself to tell yourself right now. And know that at any given moment, we have the ability to choose our emotion and our story. Change your emotion, change your story, see what happens. I think that is part of the commitment to personal excellence. It is honoring my values, honoring who I am. It is being aware of the story I'm allowing to run through my mind. How fast am I breathing right now? What's my body language right now? What's the emotion I'm holding right now? And are these things enabling me or disabling me? Are they empowering me or disempowering me? That's the choice. And I think personal excellence comes down to that one thing. I make a choice about who I am, what I stand for, and how I choose to respond in any given moment. And those little triggers like that allow you to reset over and over and over again. And sometimes I have to reset 10 times in the day, 20 times in the day, but I reset. And we all get distracted. We all get angry. We all get full of fear. I certainly do. But high-performing people spend less and less time in those unhelpful states. It's called the emotional refractory phase. They identified faster. I'm now telling myself a story. I'm now entertaining an emotion that is not helping me. And then they reset quickly. So your emotional refractory phase is the amount of time it takes you to identify an unhelpful emotion or thought and change it. The shorter the emotional refractory phase, the more successful you become.
That's fascinating. So it's about daily resets and often multiple times per day. I wanted to ask you that. Do you get ever things like self-doubt, imposter syndrome, things like that?
Every day. Every day. And I think that's the gift. That's the human condition. And self-doubt can be a healthy thing at times. I get angry. I experience fear. There's a great movie called A Beautiful Mind. Mm. So if people have ever watched that movie, it's about incredible professor John Nash, Nobel winner, one of the greatest minds of all time. But somewhere along his life's journey, he develops schizophrenia. And now he begins to see characters that he thinks are real. And they lead him on a life of destruction. He ends up losing his job and everything. Eventually, he starts to get therapy. Eventually, he begins to move through that. He ends up back lecturing. He ends up winning a Nobel Prize. Magnificent. But here's the important thing. The very last scene, he's standing backstage, about to be called on to receive his Nobel Prize. His wife is dressed there, and it's like she has been his steadfast rock through all this. She's never given up on him. And it's like, this is the pinnacle. They're both there together, and now they're old, and this is it. And just before he walks out, he looks over, and she realizes he's watching something, but there's nobody there. And then she says, "My God, John, do you still see them?" And he said, "Every day. But now I know they're not true. I have self-doubt. I have fear. But I know they're not true. I do not let them impact my decisions." We all have these imposters. We all have these unhelpful emotions. I entertain them for a little while and then I realize you're not real. Is that story really real? Am I really not good at this? Is that really impossible? I think that's an amazing thing. I work with some of the greatest sports people, some of the greatest sports business people on this planet, and they experience self-doubt every day.
I think it's so important to hear that, because I think people have this when I fallacy. When I get elite, I won't have this. I won't have this anymore. I won't have doubt. I won't have anger. I won't have rage. Where in reality, it's not that. It's just how you process it.
Of course.
I mean, a beautiful way of putting it. I know they're not real.
I know they're not real.
It's a simple reframing, but it's so powerful to go that beautiful image of, I see them, acknowledge them, not real.
I know. It's the same even with a panic attack. I mean, you know, for me, I'm still not at the point where I can say, well, I'll probably never have a panic attack again. I get panic attacks. But when I'm having them, I'm like, I'm entertaining them, saying, oh, I had a panic attack, so something's going on here. And as I'm having it, I'm letting it unfold and I'm thinking, why is this now? What's my diet been like? And it's like, okay, you panic. You do what you need to do, panic attack. And as soon as you're over, I'm just getting on with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the human condition is dark and light. The human condition, you know, is that we get to experience there's no such thing as a negative emotion. People wrongly say positive and negative emotions. Every emotion is real. Every emotion is a symptom. Every emotion is a piece of information. It's what you do with the emotion that matters. And I love that scene where she says, like, some people might look at me and say, she's, he never experienced. No, I see fear. I know. And she said, my God, John, you still see them. He's like, every day, but now I know they're not real.
That's so good. I love that.
I experience every emotion, but I choose which ones I act on. I hear myself tell myself all types of stories. I choose which ones I listen to. I choose my response. World the world is not happening to me anymore. I've chosen not to be a victim. I'm going to be a conscious, empowered choice maker. That's my choice. Does that mean all my challenges go away? No. Does that mean life is always plain sailing? No. But the mindset I bring is going to make those challenges bigger or smaller than they need to be. So in life, you're either focused on your point of pain, and we all have pain, or you're focused on your point of power. And even when we talk about pain, there's a massive difference in pain and suffering. Pain is inevitable. Pain is the stuff that happens. Your business fails. Someone backs out of a contract. That's pain. Pain is your child is sick. That's pain. Life has pain. Suffering is your reaction to the pain. Your anger, your resistance, your resentment. The quicker you accept reality for what it is allows you to move on with greater freedom and greater power. Now you can impact change. Acceptance isn't about saying, oh, well, sure, it is what it is. I can't change it. Accepting is, okay, we're 6 points down. I'm after making the worst put of all time. I'm after losing a massive contract. But that's not the story. The story is going to be how I responded to that.
The comeback.
And that's what I ultimately have trained myself and I trained my clients. Even when the bad stuff happens, that's not the story. The story is my response to this. And I think if people got nothing else from this podcast but that one thing, to when something is happening, and I work with people who've lost their children, I work with people who have been in situations that you think they could never come back for. And yes, they go through grief. And yes, it's a horrible process. And at some point, they say, but that's not the end of the story. Viktor Frankl, concentration camp survivor, 4 different concentration camps, lost his wife, lost his 2 children, and yet he made a decision. When my life is over, the story will not be about the concentration camps. The story will be about how I responded to being in a concentration camp. And I think, what an amazing message. Mm. So when I work with teams, when I work with business people and business leaders, world is uncertain. Things are unpredictable. In a split second, things change. You have to be mentally fit, mentally calm, physically ready. And when you're in that high-performing state, and that happens, you can step in there with calm, with focus, and you can ask yourself, what's important now? Your team sit around the table with a smile on their face and say, this is not the story. The story is going to be about how we dare to respond in this situation. And I know you've had Laura Bonn on this, and what an incredible lady. No matter what happened, we had this mantra that worked on together for the better, for the better. She met triumph and disaster with the same thing. You don't believe in me, and that's okay. But I'm going to find someone who does. You don't believe in my product, that's okay. I'll find someone that does. You don't believe in me, that's okay. I'll find someone that does. And thank you for your rejection, because every rejection is a redirection. She learned from every rejection. She learned from every pitfall. She learned from every setback. And at no point did she take it to heart, because she had this unwavering belief, I'm going to do this. And I think it was even more than that. I don't know if it was, I'm going to do this. She promised herself one thing. I will do absolutely everything I can to make this work. Mm. I will discover meditation. I will become physically fitter. I will tell myself new stories. I will release myself from unhelpful subconscious programs. I will deal with my trauma. I will get myself ready to be the leader that this business deserves. And when people meet me, so I think when she meets investors, I think beyond the product, I think they just look at her and say, Jesus, who's this lady?
She's an exceptional.
Yeah. She's a force of nature.
Yeah. That morning with her was exceptional. She made an impact on me beyond a lot of people, because she's just an exceptional person. She could be selling anything. I wouldn't really care what
I was just going to say, wait until you see what she does next.
Oh, for sure.
She's going to change millions of lives.
Yeah. There's no doubt about that.
And But the commitment, she makes to personal excellence. People forget that. And yeah. people might say, oh, you've done very well. And she's, it's hard work. And she's put herself in the way of learning and development and meditation and all of this stuff that I talk about that a lot of businesses, because that's waffle. How is that going to help your business? Well, she knew, particularly at the start of COVID, I'm probably in for a 5-year battle here where it's going to be rejection after rejection, where it's going to be challenge after that. I better be up for this. So she knew she was climbing Everest. And climbing Tarantul wasn't good enough for her. She didn't just want an ordinary brand. She wanted something on a global level. So she asked herself, if I'm going to climb Everest, I better get myself physically, mentally and emotionally fit to climb it. And I think you have to be fit to lead. But it's not just physically fit. You have to build a team of people who are deeply connected to each other, who deeply believe in each other, who care and trust for each other, who turn up for each other and who are willing to do the work every day to turn up with excellence. So there's a lovely expression that says the strength of the wolf is the pack. That kind of makes sense. But if you have a pack full of weak wolves, it's still a weak pack. So the strength of the wolf is the pack, but the strength of the pack is the wolf. So I sit around senior leadership teams and I ask them, what are we willing to do to make this a success? What are we willing to take on? How are we going to transform the way we think, the way we feel, the way we speak, the way we operate? A lot of people say to me, oh, you know, I'd do anything for the people I love. I'd die for my family. And I say, well, like, don't worry about that. Don't die for your family. Would you get fit for your family? Would you meditate for your family?
That's the irony.
Would you give up processed food for your family? And would you live for your family? Oh, well, that sounds hard. Yeah. Brian Cody once said, you know, he said, I hear all these hurling teams saying, oh, we die for the county. He said, Kilkenny hurlers, we don't. We're not willing to die for the county. We'll kill for the county. That's a different mindset.
Yeah. Victim mentality to winner's mentality. Just and it's two words.
Victim to victory.
Yeah.
You got to look yourself in the mirror every morning. You got to ask yourself, am I turning up with compassion? Have I stopped comparing myself to other people? Am I giving myself permission to live life with passion? Am I getting myself physically, mentally, emotionally in the best possible state to be the best that I can be? And am I willing to really go after this? Am I really going to go after this? Am I going to align intention and attention? Am I going to surround myself with people who call out my bullshit, who call out my excuses? Am I going to surround myself with people who deeply love me? Am I happy to climb Tarantul or am I going after Everest? And for some people, Tarantul is fine.
How do you visualize success? How should a founder who's sitting here going, Jerry has said some things there that I am just absolutely motivated by. How does visualization play a piece here?
Visualization for me is right person with the right process. Firstly, think about, write down. So I'll do this exercise with you right now. And you don't have to call this out, but I want you to put three lines on the page. So you have three pillars.
Mm-hmm.
In one pillar, put them vertically up and down the sheet. That's it. Now, over on the right-hand side, I want you to write down three outcomes you'd want to achieve in life. So whether that's, you could be one financial, it could be, doesn't matter what it is. So that's the outcome. And that goes on the line at the right. The middle line is process. Then at some point when you have time, I want you to write down 5 process enablers beside every goal. So I want to have more money. Write down 5 things you can do every day. I want to get fitter. 5 things you can do every day. I want to be more calm. 5 things. So now you have the outcome, but you have process. Now here's the visualization. Let's say your goal is I want to earn 100 million a year. I want to have a thriving business. I want to be married to a beautiful person. I want to have great fun in my life. I want to be, you know, open to incredible adventure, and I want to live life with confidence and ease. Close down your eyes right now. Just close your eyes. I want you to imagine you're sitting outside a hotel on a park bench. I want you to imagine a car pulls up. The person that's about to get out of that car has already achieved everything that you've just wrote down on that piece of paper. Hugely successful, financially secure, beautiful, loving relationship, living life with ease and grace. I want you to see the door open. I want you to see them step out. What do they look like? What's the body language like? The guy comes out from the hotel to take in their bags. How do they speak to him? What do you notice about them? What do you notice about the words they use? The tone of voice? Now that you look at that person, what words would you use to describe them? Maybe the words like calm, confident. Detail orientated. Are they turning up in the car? It's full of crap, and they haven't cleaned it out in 6 months, and it's full of, and they haven't washed it. Are they half dressed, half shaven? Look at the person who has already achieved everything that you would like to have. Now open your eyes. Write down 5 words that describe the person you saw. Now, out of 10, so 10 being that is exactly who I am, 5 is I'm halfway there. I want you to put a number. When you look at who you are right now, put a number beside each of those words. And be honest, if they're 10s, put down 10s and don't feel that you need to downplay or upplay. Just be real, be honest. They could be all 10s. How do I know?
Mm-hmm.
Give me some of the numbers you've caught.
4, 6, 7.
Okay, so that's the gap. Joe Dispenza taught me life doesn't give you what you want. Life gives you who you are. Become the person first. I had to transform who I was, the way I lived, the way I spoke. So you asked me about visualization. You can't visualize as if it's somewhere down the road and it might happen. You visualize with incredible clarity as if it's already happened. So when I visualize, when I saw myself stand in the concert hall, I was so, like it happened. Nobody could tell me it hadn't happened. We visualize with our brain, but more importantly, we visualize with our heart. So now you begin to experience the elevated emotions as if it's already happened.
It was funny. I was playing that movie in my head. I just knew the hotel I was outside. I knew exactly what it was. I knew the car. I knew the street. I could feel it. I could feel the sun. I knew how warm it was. It was incredible.
So for me, the right person with the right process never worries about the outcome. So list your outcomes. Then beside every outcome, put 5 process enablers that you can do every day to achieve that. And then more importantly, work every single morning on becoming that person. You can't have something. And even if you don't believe in yourself and you're stressed and you're all over the place and you achieve great success, I promise you, you'll lose it very quickly because you don't believe you deserve it. It's like people who believe they're not lovable. They find someone who loves them, but they believe it's not real or maybe they should. The relationship will end. We can't outlive our subconscious programs. So I think what I've learned in my life is to see a dream. Like I saw myself walking around Olympic Village before I even knew what Olympic Village looked like. I saw it. It had happened. My first day ever working with the Olympic boxing team, I knew I was going to be in the Olympic Village. I knew we were going to win medals. And because I had that feeling of certainty, I think they said, oh, fuck it, this guy is certain about something. And then they had it. I was certain, they were certain, there was no doubt. So I think visualization, if it's left to just an intellectual exercise, and we talk about things like, I will be successful, I will be, that's no good. It has to be in the current. I am an incredible speaker. I fill out 1,000-seater events regularly. I walk with ease and joy. And I think too many people are trying to achieve an outcome and either the process isn't right or they're not the right person. So my message is visualization allows you to step completely into that person every day. You live their life, you have those thoughts, and you live with those elevated emotions. And now your heart is connected. So the brain receives a signal, but your heart sends out a signal. Now you're transmitting a magnificent frequency into the universe. And you're saying, I'm ready for success. I'm ready for that Jeep. I'm ready for that wealth. I'm ready. And then someone is looking for somebody of impeccable standards who's ready to be successful, that they can trust with their billion-dollar idea. And they look at you in a coffee shop and say, he looks fucking interesting. And they walk over and just say to you, how are you doing? And before you know it, you walk out of the coffee shop and say, that guy said, can I meet you next week? You say, how did that happen? It happened because you beamed a signal into the universe. I am the type of person that can be trusted. I'm the type of person who can lead. I'm the type of person that is calm in the face of adversity. I am the type of person who, if I say I'm going to do something, I do it. And when you become that person and you live as that person every day, watch out, because opportunity after opportunity is going to fall into your lap.
Enterprise Ireland helps to support and fund a vibrant startup ecosystem, providing supports, insights, and network connections to the most ambitious Irish startups. From expert advice to raising funding, exploring opportunities in international markets, to strategic planning, Enterprise Ireland is here to support you in those important startup moments. For more information about how Enterprise Ireland can support you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Enterprise Ireland, helping Irish startups go global.
Jerry, this has been powerful. We're going to do a quick fire round.
Okay.
Right. One line, each of these hit me. That episode, Jerry, is sensational. So thank you very much. What book should every founder read?
I would say Man's Search for Meaning. I think it's a great book. It's very difficult. It's a tough read. So there's another great book called The Choice by Edith Edgar. Both concentration camp, both yes. Work together. So The Choice. And I also think The Five Regrets of the Dying. I think it's an incredible book. Too many people, rich and poor, live an incredible life, racing and chasing, building billion-dollar companies, and at the end, they all had the same regrets. And I read the book, and you realize the only mission I have is, at the end of my life, I'm going to have no regrets. That's my mission. That is my ultimate definition of success. So, The Five Regrets of the Dying. I think Louise Hay, You Can Heal Your Life, and I know that's a controversial one, because there's no science behind that. She transformed my life. She transformed the way I speak. She taught me that you can literally speak yourself into existence. Change your story, change your words. Deepak Chopra, Ageless Body, Timeless Mind. Incredible. And any of my two books I've put in there as well.
What books have you got? Just share them.
Awaken Your Power Within was my first book, and The Freedom Within was the second book.
What we'll do is we'll give away a copy of each of those.
Phenomenal.
That? Love it. We'll do a social media giveaway and give away both those.
Brilliant. Thank you.
What have you learned the hard way?
I've learned the hard way that I can be too quick to blame other people. I can be too quick to feel hard done by. And I've learned that at times I can be very good at swallowing my emotions and swallowing my pain. When I'm at my worst, I'm blaming other people. I'm moving too fast. I'm bottling up and I'm swallowing emotions and pain. That's when I'm at my worst. And that's where I have to really keep an eye on those things.
What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
What would I do if I do 10 million euro? I would put some aside for my children, and then I would look for the likes of Laura Lynn, who I try to raise money for every year, Jack and Jill, who are totally underfunded. There is so many incredibly deserving charities out there, but when you've two parents about to lose a child, I don't know if there's any pain like that in the world. And these have stepped into that incredible space. And they have a beautiful line that says, we can't always extend the amount of days in the life, but we can extend the amount of life in the days. I've gone over there a few times. It's unnerving, but man, is it inspiring. I would try to give a lot of that to charities like that, who try to be there for parents when the world is falling apart. And they can't solve the problem, but they can turn up with compassion and joy and love, and they can let those parents know that they're not alone. I think that alone is magnificent. So that would probably get a lot of it.
It's a good answer. I'm going to get you to invest €1 million for us. You can give it to one person or one company. Who would you give it to? That's a tricky one for you now, because you know a lot of people.
For €1 million. If I could get Laura Bonner to come with me on the process of exposing the dangers of processed food and the impact that has on children, obesity, anxiety, depression. Because Laura Bonner is the type of lady that I'd go to war with. And I know that every cent of that would be spent well. And I know that for that €1 million, she'd probably give me €10 million worth, because she's just, and that's what I'm saying, I have an idea what she's going to do next. And just watch out. So I just think anybody right now that's willing to take on this difficult question about why are so many children ill at the moment? Why have we so much anxiety? Why is every chronic illness in the world? We know why. Because it's the big companies who are selling us crap, and particularly companies who sell highly processed, ultra processed crap wrapped in the idea of a child's food or wrapped in some type of health and fitness bar.
That's a big one.
They just drive me bananas. Yeah. If you're selling crap food, tell people this is crap, but it's great for a treat and have one or two a week, and that's great. I have no problem with those food companies.
80-20.
Yeah, no problem with those companies. So I'd give €1 million to you, Laura, and I'd say, right, let's have a massive impact if we can.
I'd back that. I'd definitely be on board with that. I'd be throwing my $5,000 in. if you were starting a company, this is slightly related. If you were starting a new business in 2025, I like to inspire founders who are listening, maybe with some new ideas. What area would you build it in?
For me, because the passion I have, I would start a business where people begin to realize that you can have a massive impact on your own future health and longevity of your life. And now people are beginning to spend money investing in the long-term health of themselves. And that is through regular testing, regular screening, but a way of living as well. And I would love to have a business. I think there's a huge opportunity. I think all of these ultra processed food companies, pharmaceutical companies, I think a lot of them are going to come under pressure now, because the science is now highlighting. People are looking for a new way. Consciousness is shifting. People realize we have to take our health into our own hands. People realize that are realizing the greatest money you'll spend is in health. The greatest gift you have is health. And how do we protect that? How do we mind that? And I think that's the future. I think lifestyle medicine is the future of medicine. And I think proactive preventative care is the ultimate care we can take. So I think we're only beginning to come on that journey.
I believe that as well. I started in 2020 and then it's just changed my life. Yeah. Honestly, it's just changed how I approach everything. It's changed how I eat, drink, sleep, move. What's been your best investment?
My best investment is, even though I would say it's not an investment, it's my house, because it makes my wife and kids so happy. I, even though we're thinking of changing recently, and my little boy is 4, he was listening to all this and said, Daddy, are we selling our house? I said, would you like to? No. I said, why? Don't sell my playroom. And people say, oh, you know, investment, and I'm a bad investor. But I've bought a house, whether it's too dear or too cheap. My wife loves where we live. My kids love living there, and I love being in their happiness. It's the greatest thing I've ever done. We lived for a long time because we couldn't afford a house, and we're moving and shifting, and that's fine. That has to be done. But we have our own house now. We have our own home, and we only have it for a few years. It's been a long process, and for years, I, you know, but to see the happiness in that, And people think about buying a house and a home. And my wife, you know, makes me remember regularly that there's a big difference in a house and a home.
Mm. House is bricks. A home is where you live.
A home is, and I would just say, you know, if you can build a home that has a little bit more love, a little more fun, a little less screen, a little less, the most of joy I get is just watching my kids in the house. And, so I think that's been the biggest thing I've ever bought. It's not an investment, but it's an investment in, it's given us a sense of security. I see my little kids off playing with Kula now. We're connected to that. It's his identity. And after years of being on the road and not owning a house, I see the impact this has. It's magnificent.
There's something powerful there. Mm. There 100% is. What's been your worst investment?
Worst investment? I invested far too much of my time to people who weren't serious about what I wanted to do. I invested too much of my time to people that were going to rob my ideas. I've had loads of ideas robbed. And I've wasted too much of my time self-doubting myself. The greatest asset I have is my thoughts and my time. And I probably spent I probably spent far too long thinking, waffling, waiting. And when I look at what I could have done and what I could have built in that time. So that's what I would say to people now. If you feel it's the right time, if you have an idea, go do it. Just cut the distraction out, cut the waffle out. That's the worst investment I ever made. I put my time into people and things that actually weren't serious about what I was serious about.
You've half answered my final question of the day. What's your final piece of advice to every founder listening?
Every founder is, firstly, know why you do it. So I wanted three things when I set my business up. I wanted financial freedom. Put a number to that. Because you can chase money and you can chase, there's a lovely expression that says, when did enough become not enough? Mm-hmm. Know what enough is. Know what financial freedom is. So I wrote a number and I went to that number, which is great. Second is I wanted freedom to plan my own diary and work with people who inspired me. And the third was I wanted freedom to work wherever I wanted to work. So freedom was a big thing for me. I would say to any founder, ask why you're doing this. What's the why it's going to get you out of bed every day? If it's financial, that's okay, but know how much is enough. If it goes deeper than that. And then secondly, find the people who believe in you. Find the people who believe in what you believe in and get rid of everybody else. Get rid of everybody else. And then measure all the time. Measure what you're doing. Is it having an impact? Is it moving the dial? Are you moving in the right direction? Measure where you're spending your time. Is it having an impact? What's taking up your energy? What's consuming your thoughts? Is it having an impact? So be ruthless about where you spend your time. Be ruthless about what you give your energy to. Align intention and attention. And the most important thing is turn up every day from a place of personal excellence as if it's already happened.
Jerry. That is 1 hour and 40 minutes of absolute inspiration. Thank you so much. That's been powerful. And I do appreciate most of all your time.
Myself.
Where can people learn more about you and what you do?
Jerryhussey.ie is my website. If you want to email us, info@jerryhussey.ie. We have a big event on April the 6th. I'm not sure if this podcast will be out before or after.
How about we plan it before that, right?
April the 6th. And my Instagram is @jerryhussey. So, and a thing like that. And as I said, if it's anybody that emails us, I meet them and we discuss what they want, and very quickly it's a yes or no. But we have some great programs and programs that I'm really passionate to run, and whether it's a senior leadership team, whether it's a business leader himself or herself that just wants to improve, it's kind of the same message. It's like, I have a shop with five different windows, but it's the same product. It's personal excellence. It's personal freedom, personal liberation.
I love that definition. Personal excellence. Jerry Hussey, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.